This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Our next guest, David Niyosi, does not pull his punches. He says the religious right has been a disaster for this country. He says it has imposed an outsized and overbearing influence on our national politics at the expense of reason, critical thinking, science, and ethics. And he goes further, saying the rise of the religious right correlates with an array of social ills, from high rates of violent crime and teen pregnancy to low rates of scientific literacy.
But Niyosi also says there's a growing movement to counter the religious right. Non-religious, secular Americans who, for a long time, felt marginalized in the country. Niyosi says they are now emerging as a force to be reckoned with. While a large majority of Americans believe in God, many are losing faith in organized religion. And at the same time, the number of Americans who say they don't have any religious identity has doubled since 1980.
David Niyosi says these secular Americans represent a growing force that can and should challenge the dominance of the religious right. Niyosi is the president of the American Humanist Association and the author of a new book, Non-Believer Nation: The Rise of Secular Americans. He's also an attorney here in Boston. He joins us now in the studio. And David Niyosi, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, before we talk about what you describe as the rise of secular Americans, talk about your concern about the religious right, which you lay out pretty well in this book. What has the religious right done to the politics and discourse in this country?
Well, I think Americans, and not just secular Americans, but all Americans, are paying a terrible price for the rise of the religious right. We usually date the rise of the religious right to about 1979, 1980, when the moral majority first came on the scene, Jerry Falwell leading the way, and they helped elect Ronald Reagan. And I think most Americans felt that it was a passing phase, something that surely wouldn't last, the idea of politically engaged fundamentalist Christians driving politics. But certainly it didn't pass. 30 years later, we have a country that in many ways is dysfunctional. The political discourse is juvenile. Public policy is just suffering in so many different areas.
Give me a specific example, though. I mean,
well,
because
politics, for example, look at the political discourse now. We have candidates running for office holding prayer rallies before announcing their candidacy. We have numerous candidates now are openly rejecting evolution. Here we are, the second decade of the 21st century, openly rejecting evolution and embracing creationist ideas. Education policy is suffering. The rejection of science permeates education policy. We have abstinence-only education, which has proven not to work. Environmental policy is suffering. We have the denial of climate change, driven very much by fundamentalist Christians. So it's all over the place. And worse than all of that, Anthony, is the general anti-intellectual climate that seems to accompany the religious right in so many areas.
Now, you suggest that there is an opportunity for secular, for non-religious Americans to respond differently, and that your numbers are growing. And I want to ask you about that. But let me first sort of ask it this way. Aren't Americans still overwhelmingly religious? I mean, I'm looking at a recent Gallup poll, which I know you've seen as well. 90% of Americans still believe in God, and that more Americans still go to church or believe in God than their counterparts in any other Western country. So doesn't that suggest pretty fertile ground for a sort of religious-based politics?
The answer to your question, are Americans religious, is yes and no. Mm-hmm. We are religious, more religious than most other developed Western countries, but there's a lot of exaggeration about the degree of American religiosity. For some reason, the realm of politics has to be much more pious than every other area of American culture, where there really is a strong, very strong secular heritage in this country. Secularity is something that Americans really appreciate in most other areas of life. Entertainment, culture, the arts. Religious skepticism has a great tradition in this country. Yet once we venture into the realm of politics, there's all this talk from the media and from politicians about how Americans are so pious. That's not really true at all. If you want a very religious country, try Somalia or Saudi Arabia. That is a religious society. America is somewhat more religious than other developed countries, but a country country also that appreciates irreverence and religious skepticism and secularity, and we need to bring that appreciation of reason and secularity into the public policy realm.
I want to play a cut of tape because you make a very interesting point in your book that even liberal politicians in this country, the ostensible opponents to the religious right, often make reference to their own piety, to their own religious faith in confronting them. So here's a cut from the late Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy. This is from his Faith, Trust, and Tolerance in America speech, October 3rd, 1983, at the Liberty Baptist College in Lynchburg, Virginia. Let's just listen for a moment.
I am an American and a Catholic. I love my country and treasure my faith. But I do not assume that my conception of patriotism or policy is invariably correct, or that my convictions about religion should command any greater respect than any other faith in this pluralistic society.
So the late Ted Kennedy, and the point there is he sort of makes this point, I'm an American, but I'm a Catholic, I love my country, and I treasure my faith. And you say too often those who oppose the religious right are too quick to sort of tout their own faith, right?
Kennedy's statement is a beautiful statement, yeah. And it's certainly something that belongs in the public discourse. But what I point out in Nonbeliever Nation is that while that opposition to the religious right was going from liberal and moderate politicians and sometimes even conservative politicians who like to point out their own religiosity, even though they disagreed on social issues with the moral majority, and also from advocacy groups such as People for the American Way, the ACLU, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, these advocacy groups also tended to associate themselves with religion when they could by putting people, religious leaders, in leadership positions, on boards, and even in officer positions.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, that's fine, but there needs to be an added element to the opposition to the religious right, and that element is the inclusion of the secular demographic. Those millions of non-religious Americans, and it really is millions, openly reject the idea that somehow religion is synonymous with morality and that public policy needs to be crafted only by those people who are religious, as if public policy is a debate between the religious left and the religious right. When the debate is solely among religious people, that really lends credibility to the religious right's claim of moral superiority, because after all, who's more religious than the religious right? When we include the secular demographic in the dialogue, that just opens it all up to so that religion itself as a driving force of politics is diminished. And reason, arguments need to be won by reason, not just claims of piety.
Well, I want to talk to you about what we know about the growth of this, of secular Americans. But first, I want to invite our listeners into this conversation. What do you think of David Niosi's case? Are you a non-believer looking for a cause? Do you feel it's time to confront the religious right? Is there room in America for a secular movement, or are we an overwhelmingly religious country? Let us know what you think. 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also comment at radioboston.org and find us on Twitter and Facebook at Radio Boston. We've already got a couple of comments on Facebook. Kurt Kaletka writes, this is a secular nation where religious beliefs are tolerated and not a religious nation where religious beliefs are codified. David Niosi, you wrote something in your book that's very intriguing to me. You write that about what you called a closeted secularity that you say is very dangerous. First of all, why do people feel they have to be closeted secularists? And I assume here we're talking about the political class. And what's the danger here?
It's mainly the political class, but it's also ordinary Americans often feel that they need to be closeted as well. And that's not just an opinion. That's a fact, and I can point to statistics to show it. Only about 1 or 2% of Americans openly identify as atheists. But the most respected survey of American religious belief, the American Religious Identification Survey conducted by Trinity College down in Connecticut, showed that only about 81% of Americans actually affirm religious belief. 69% believe, not religious belief, God belief. Mm-hmm. 69% believe in a personal God and 12% believe in a higher power. So there's a disconnect. There's about 19% of Americans who do not affirm a belief in a divinity, but only 2% identifying as atheists. That tells us that there's a stigma associated with secularity, with at least with atheist identity. And it's it's a stigma that is fading. The younger generation doesn't really see it the way that the older generation does, and that's a good thing, and it shows the trend going in our direction.
Well, I want to play another piece of tape just to get this keep this conversation going. We're going to fast forward from that speech by Ted Kennedy to President Barack Obama's 2008 inaugural address. Let's just listen for a few seconds.
For we know that our patchwork heritage is a strength, not a weakness. We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers.
There's the word, non-believers. What did you think when you heard that?
Viva secularity. That's what I thought.
But does that, in your view, does that represent progress? There's a president of the United States sort of acknowledging that non-believers are out there and not somehow part of some group of immoral people that should be shunned.
Yes, it's certainly progress, and it's one of many signs that the secular movement, which really is in its infancy, I would date it to less than 10 years old, it's getting traction. All over the place we're seeing progress. We're seeing secular student groups spring up all over the country at a pace that the organization that oversees them, the Secular Student Alliance, can't even keep up with the demand. And now they're going into high schools.
Tell me about this. I wanted to ask you about this, the Secular Student Alliance. This is a national umbrella organization, right, of college, of secular college students and atheists. And you found that it's expanded in a big way over the past several years, from just a few dozen campus groups in 2007 to hundreds today, right?
That's right. And it really shows something. It shows that among young people, secular identity is something that is very, very important to them oftentimes. I think atheists and agnostics have been around college campuses for as long as there have been college campuses, pretty much. But in recent years, because of the pervasive influence of conservative religion in American public life, and also for other reasons such as social networking and online media, the idea of secular identity is something that is very important to many young people. They see it as a way to define themselves to the world. You know, if you're appalled by the agenda of the religious right and its attacks on education, the environment, and science and all that, what easier way and what more efficient way to say so than simply saying, I'm an atheist?
David Niosi is the author of Non-Believer Nation, The Rise of Secular Americans. What do you think about what you're hearing? Give us a call. Join the conversation. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's take a call from Jane, who's calling from Waltham. Hi, Jane.
Hi. How are you?
Very well.
I think you're leaving out another important group. People don't divide only into these two categories you're discussing. I, like many other people in my mainline Protestant church, are firm believers in the deity of Jesus Christ, but we also have great respect for science. Many members of our congregation are physicists and biologists and other categories of science. And they're Republicans and they're Democrats, and they have varying beliefs on social issues. But we all love God and try to serve him. And I think there are many Americans like us.
All right, Jane. Well, I really appreciate the call and for you adding that point to the conversation. David Niosi, do you want to say something to Jane? She's talking about people who are believers but who seem to embrace a sort of progressive political view as well.
Sure. And I don't disagree with that. And I welcome working with believers towards rational public policy. We're having a discussion about the effect of the religious right on America. So we've been focusing on that, but certainly not all religious Americans are sympathetic to the religious right. What's important to realize, though, is that the opposition to the religious right has been very ineffective for the last 30 years. So the opposition has been driven mainly by religious liberals who have been trying to push back by saying, well, not all religious people are social conservatives and whatnot. But we need to realize that the inclusion of secular Americans, I would invite people like the last caller to work in coalition with secular Americans to push for rational public policy, because if they team up with secular Americans, there's a much better chance of pushing back against the agenda of the religious right.
You've mentioned that opposition to the religious right has not been successful since the 1980 and the rise of Jerry Falwell and the moral majority. Why not? I mean, you've made this point that the opposition too often – wants to evoke its own faith. But is that the only reason?
Well, I think they're very well organized, mm-hmm. very well funded, and they do have numbers. In a democratic system, if you have numbers, you're going to get some traction. There's also, at times, corporate interests that feed the religious right because, for example, corporate interests that are opposed to climate change, and I point this out in my book, they work with religious conservatives that give the appearance of grassroots opposition to climate change legislation. So there's a whole host of factors that come into it.
I want to ask you about one of the big points you raise in your book, and it's a really interesting one and a controversial one, and that is more and more politicians will make reference to the United States as a Christian nation. And it's not just the Sarah Palins out there. It's become a pretty mainstream view in Congress. It's a point of view that obviously flies in the face of what you represent. But to many Americans, it's hardly controversial. I mean, to say, you know, there's a sort of Christian cultural tradition that we reflect out there. But how difficult is that to counter, and is that part of the problem that you see?
Well, it is part of the problem because it's part of the overall exaltation and exaggeration of the importance of religion in American public life. I don't think anyone denies that America has a religious heritage. Of course it does. Most countries do. But what we hear from the religious right is this attempt to really exalt Christianity in particular as a defining theology that seems to cover American life, and they want it to define American law as well, and that's the real problem. So America is not a Christian nation. It's a nation of majority Christians, but that does not make it a Christian nation. To define a nation as a Christian nation is to say a lot. It's not just to suggest that Christianity had an influence on the country or that the country demographically is majority Christian. You're saying that the nation is defined through Christianity, and that's just incorrect.
And politicians like Michelle Bachmann not long ago actually came out and said on the record that the idea of the separation of church and state is a myth.
That's right.
And that gets put out there and it gets circulated and gets digested to a certain point.
It goes to show how the dialogue and the agenda of the religious right gets more and more bold as they get more and more traction over the years. Such statements never would have been uttered in public life.
Let's take a call from Dan, who's calling from Lynn. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm really enjoying the discussion today. I spent 6 years in the U.S. Air Force, and I was really wondering if your guests could comment on the evangelical structure of the United States military, because I know myself, as a foxhole atheist, it was very, very difficult for myself and others like me to gain any recognition, and we would be, you know, actively acted against and fought against at every turn. It was a big struggle just to get atheists listed on my dog tags.
And Dan, when you say a foxhole atheist, you're talking about a closeted atheist. Is that what you mean by that?
No, the old adage is there are no atheists in foxholes.
I see.
Those of us in the military community like to refer to ourselves as foxhole atheists once we're out and it's known that we're non-believers.
David Niosi, Dan's question about the evangelical social structure of the military.
It is a huge problem. It is definitely a problem that the secular community is trying to address. And it's part of the general theme of conflating patriotism with religiosity. And that's one of the themes that the secular movement is very much trying to address. Patriotism is not synonymous with religion, but once we enter the military situation, it seems to be the case. Religious favoritism is all over the place in the military. Just about anyone who's been in the military can tell you how there are incidents where you can have a choice on Sunday morning of either scrubbing floors or going to church. It's not surprising that many people express an interest in trying to find Jesus in such a situation. And we had a huge scandal at the Air Force Academy a few years back. We have very high profile, and I'm not just talking ordinary officers, but officers with access to the very top level of the executive branch talking about how America is a Christian nation and how the war against Islam is a religious war. This is a very serious problem, and it's something that I thank the caller for bringing bring it up because it's just one more reason that the secular movement is so important. And the secular movement, by the way, is trying to make inroads in the military, and it's having some success.
Mm. David Nyusi, one of the more controversial, I think, parts of your book is that you have a section where you talk about the religious right, the rise of the religious right, correlating with a whole host of social ills, from higher rates of homicides, juvenile and early adult mortality, STD infection rates, teen pregnancy and abortion. So even if a correlation exists through time, does that really imply causation? I mean, is that what you're saying?
That's an excellent question, and the answer is not necessarily, but that's not the point we're making. I think the statistics are overwhelming at how much social problems seem to follow religious societies as opposed to more secular societies. And interestingly, it applies within the United States. When you look at more religious states compared to less religious states, the social problems are all on the side of the religious states. And it applies internationally when you compare the religious United States to more secular developed countries. But the point we're making is not necessarily that the religiosity causes the social problems, but certainly, if nothing else, we can agree with such overwhelming statistics that secularity does not cause social problems. And that's what we're talking about. We're not trying to claim superiority. We're really just trying to claim equality and that we deserve a place at the table shaping American public policy.
Well, we mentioned the Secular Student Alliance, and we've seen a lot of surveys that suggest declining popularity of religion among young people. Of course, that's where the future is. Is that where you are hopeful that sort of the next generation, all these younger folks, as they come of age, are going to essentially swell your ranks and maybe bring about the kind of change that you're hoping to see?
Well, generally speaking, yes. I call my chapter on the secular student movement Reason for Hope and Hope for Reason. So I think the younger generation just doesn't see religion the way the older generation does. When you talk about associating secularity with communism, younger people will tell you, oh, that's so 20th century. And it really is. The 21st century hopefully will be the secular century.
Well, that's David Nyusi. His book is Non-Believer Nation, The Rise of Secular Americans. And David Nyusi is a Boston attorney and author. And David Nyusi, thanks so much for coming in and having this important conversation with us. We're very grateful.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, a lot of folks out there wanted to get on this conversation. It continues at radioboston.org. Info writes, thank you for having an open discussion on this topic. This is one of those subjects that matters to a lot of people, but out of discomfort or just a desire to be tolerant, they are reluctant to have. Thanks for that. Coming up, we are going to ideas, things to do this weekend, including Scottish jazz from Hamish Napier. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.